Well, good evening, everyone. Good to see you all. Okay. Kevin gave it away. We're headed to Micah. And I thought we were going to hit chapter 2 and chapter 5 tonight. And then I started, putting my thoughts down on the old computer and realized chapter 2 is going to take all of today. But, well worth it, because there's some really good stuff in here. Again, maybe not necessarily some concepts related to messianic prophecy that we haven't covered or talked about before. I mean, just in the preaching and teaching of Jesus and his word. But again, what I'm really noticing here is I prepared for Micah chapter 2 is just how, I don't know if Jared knows off the top of his head, but this is, what number is this class? I don't know if you have access to that. I'll give him a minute to look it up. But we're coming up on a year, I believe. And I was thinking back to some of the first ones we did back in Genesis. And then, the Bible question, what tribe was it prophesied that the scepter wouldn't depart from? I mean, that's Genesis chapter 49. And so 42. So we're underneath a year. We're doing good. How much the picture of Jesus has really developed as we've gone through and worked through these prophecies. And again, we'll see today that, in Genesis, it started with Jesus would be the representative of good and that his adversary would be the devil. And now we see, as we develop more, we've unpackaged, where he would be from, the tribe he'd be from, his lineage, his ministry, references to the Spirit, to the church, and we continually see Jesus with his church as we get further and further along here. So, let's see, how do we want to do this? So we're in Micah. Micah, chronologically, is going to match the timeline of Isaiah. If we go back to Micah chapter 1, just read verse 1. It says, "The word of the Lord, which came to Micah of Moresheth in the days of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, which he saw concerning Samaria and Jerusalem." So that's how we know that Micah's timeline chronologically is going to line up with Isaiah, because Isaiah prophesied to Judah during the reign of these same kings. Isaiah's ministry is going to be a few years longer than Micah's. He's going to start sooner and end later. But just as far as, if we're kind of running our head back through biblical history, Northern Kingdom, Southern Kingdom, Assyria, Babylon, captivity, as we're remembering a lot of those things, we're in that time period when Isaiah is prophesying to Judah. We also see here that looks like the focus is going to be on Judah, although this letter does have references to the northern tribe of Israel. Okay, the kings that are referenced here in verse 1, chapter 1, are kings of Judah. It tells us that. But it also says that it's the word that came to Micah concerning Samaria and Jerusalem. So Samaria is going to be a reference to Israel up north, and then Jerusalem is going to be a reference to Judah in the south. I want us to read all of chapter 2 today. What I think I'll do is we'll read verses 1 through 11 just to get some context, kind of just help us understand what's going on. Micah chapter 1 is primarily God's coming judgment. But I think the focus is why God's coming in judgment. All right? Because a lot of these major and minor prophets here, specifically this minor prophet, like you've got God's judgment is coming. God's judgment is coming. Okay? And what I've noticed about Micah is he really focuses on why God's judgment is coming. Okay? So that's the context of chapter 1. And chapter 2 continues with similar language. Judgment is coming. But I notice it seems to be a little more targeted towards oppressors. People who would oppress others. So I want us to see that here. And then if you were to go on into chapter 3, you're going to get more of these woes coming from Micah through God. Okay, and in chapter 3, he gets, and if you've glanced over to chapter 3 here, We see that he gets more specific in his judgment in chapter 3, and he starts to deal out specific woes to the leadership in Israel. If you look at verse 1, he says, "Hear now, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel." Okay, he's talking to the rulers. In verse 5, he says, "Thus says the Lord concerning the prophets." So now he's going to deal with the prophets. Okay, the kings and the prophets haven't been doing their job, so he's dealing with them individually. And then if you jump over here to verse 11, he says, referring to Israel's leaders, pronounce judgment for a bribe. Her priests instruct for a price, and her prophets divine for money. So I bring that up because what I want us to see is our focus tonight is going to be verses 12 and 13 in Micah chapter 2. And it's like wedged in the middle of all of this judgment. All right. General coming judgment, judgment on the rulers, judgment on those who oppress. But right in the middle is just this glimmer of light, this glimmer of hope and redemption. And that's where we're going to see a prophecy of Jesus and his church. Micah chapter 2, verse 1. "Woe to those who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. When morning comes, they do it, for it is in the power of their hands." You know, I just noticed a couple things. We've got the schemers, right? And they're thinking about what they're going to do the next day. They're plotting as they're laying in their beds. And so they wake up in the morning, and they're ready to go do their evil. But notice, it's in their power to do it. So, you know, you get this picture of like, woe to those who do evil things just because they can. Right? Like, I mean, I don't know, you know, how on earth do people wake up and they're like, "I'm going to be evil today." Okay? Well, typically it's because they're following the flesh, that they're carrying out the will of Satan. Okay? And that's why Jesus would say, he who doesn't gather with me scatters. You know, I don't think people intentionally wake up in the morning and are like, "I'm going to march in Satan's army." You know, but what the Bible teaches us is if you're not marching for Christ, then you're marching against him. But notice here, he's like, woe to the schemers who think about the evil they're going to do because it's in the power of their hands. He's literally saying, like, they do bad things because they can. Okay, so not good. "They covet fields and they seize them. Houses and take them away. They rob a man in his house and a man in his inheritance." Here's an example of some of the evil things they do. "Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, I am planning against this family a calamity from which you cannot remove your necks, and you will not walk haughtily, for it will be an evil time." Okay, so God's going to punish these who oppress, who do evil. You know, he says, you're not going to be able to get your neck out of this one. I imagine the point is, you got your neck in the noose, and you ain't going to be able to get it out this time. Because God's the one who's coming to punish their arrogance, as he calls them haughty. In verse 4, he says, "On that day, they will take up against you a taunt and utter a bitter lamentation and say." So, now, here's where I have a question for us. So, and I think we should understand this, because this has been the same contextual theme throughout all of the major and minor prophets, like Hosea and stuff that we've gone through. God's saying, you're arrogant, you're haughty, you're evil, and you bring harm against other people. You steal their things, right? Like he's going to say, you literally kick people out of their houses. All right? And God says, I'm going to punish you. How did God punish Israel? How did that play out? Did he bring down fireballs on Israel? Well, that was Sodom, right? What's that?
Deportation,
right? And before that, just at the hands of oppressive nations, right, Larry? So that's how we understand who the they is in verse 4. So he says, on that day when God's punishing the haughty and the oppressors, he says, they will take up against you a taunt. So they is a group of people who are going to be taunting Israel. And they're going to utter limitations, and their message is going to be, we are completely destroyed. So they're mocking them. They're mocking them. They're saying, we are completely destroyed. He exchanges the portion of my people, how he removes it from me, to the apostate, He apportions our fields. Okay, so if that's tough to kind of understand, we remember that God's going to punish Israel by the neighboring nations. And so when they come in and do that, they're going to offer up this taunt. And basically what they're saying is, you lost your land and now we got it, is what he said. Their taunt is, okay, you guys are destroyed. We're destroyed. And he says, he exchanged the portion of my people. He removes it from me. And to the apostate, he apportioned our fields. So they lost their land and he gave it to the Gentiles. They lost their land and he gave it to Assyria. They lost their land and he gave it to the Babylonians. Okay. I just sometimes think it's hard to kind of understand how the transition's there. So in verse 5, he says, therefore, you will have no one stretching a measuring line, for you by a lot in the assembly of the Lord. So what's going on here? He says, you're not going to be stretching out the measuring line. What does that mean? When we do, when you first teach kids the difference between perimeter and area, you say the perimeter is the fence. Okay, area is the grass, all right? And so I use this room, for instance, because we can quickly get up from our seats and, you know, grab a yardstick or walk it off, and we can figure out how long, you know, this wall is, and that's the length. And we can find out how long that wall is, and that's the width, and then we can find the area, okay? Another way that works really good is just counting chairs, okay? You can do the number of chairs per row times the number of rows in a section, and then you can multiply that. So my point is, we get out the yardstick, we get out the measuring tools to find out how much area we have, right? Well, God just said they lost their land, right? And gave it to Assyria. So his point there is, you will not have anyone stretching out a measuring line for you by lot in the assembly of the Lord. He's like, there's going to be nothing for you to measure anymore. It's going to be taken away. Okay. Nothing for you to measure anymore. Like someone comes in here and takes our building. It's like, can't use that in math anymore. It's not ours. Okay. Verse 6. Do not speak out. So they speak out. But if they do not speak out concerning these things, reproaches will not be turned back. I love how the Lord throws these things in here. Okay. So if you see how we have quotes inside of quotes, so it's easy to get lost here sometimes. But we see there's quotes around do not speak out. Okay, so that's what the people are saying. I mean, have the people told the prophet to not speak before? No, stop it. What do you mean they're going to take our land and we're going to have nothing to even measure, even by lot? So they get this attitude, they say, this mindset. They say, don't speak out, so they say. You know, so they speak out. But if they do not speak out concerning these things, reproaches will not be turned back. You know, basically they're just saying, you know, if you don't speak this way, it won't come about. And how many times do you see that with the kings of Israel, where they're like, should we go to battle or should we not go to battle? Am I going to overcome this sickness or am I not going to overcome this sickness? And they're like, well, go ask the people and make sure you ask the people that are going to give me a favorable answer. I would like to go to war. And they're like, oh, well, there's this hairy guy down in Jerusalem. You know, he speaks to the Lord. We should ask him what we should do. And he's like, that guy never tells me what I want to hear. You know, okay. So the people are like, don't speak this way. And if you just stop speaking this way, maybe it won't happen. They're like, let's plug their ears. No more. It is being said, O house of Jacob, is the spirit of the Lord impatient? Are these his doings? Do not my words do good to the one who's walking uprightly? And there's God's answer. Okay? It's like, if you do the right thing, God's going to reward you. Okay. Recently, my people have arisen as an enemy. You strip the robe off the garment from the unsuspecting passerby, from those who returned from war. The women of my people you evict, each one from her pleasant house. From her children you take my splendor forever. Arise and go, for this is no place of rest because of the uncleanness that brings on destruction, a painful destruction. So again, we see a couple more examples of the bad things that they're doing. And God's like, get out. Arise and go. No more wickedness and uncleanness that you bring about. Painful destruction. Excuse me, sorry. And then in verse 11 he says, if a man walking after wind and falsehood. Hey, is it good to walk after the wind and falsehood? You know, isn't the man double-minded in James that's driven and tossed by the waves of the sea, right? Just like, whoosh, going this way. Here comes in the tide. Whoosh, here we go. Like, but this, he's talking about the prophets, the false prophets. So if a man walking after the wind and falsehood had told lies and said, I will speak out to you concerning wine and liquor, he would be a spokesman to his people. You guys have probably all heard the statement, leadership reflects the attitude of the people. That's what just happened. He's like, so let's say some wishy-washy guy shows up. And his message is wine and liquor. Like, he would be your spokesman. He would be your representative. Because that's what you're up to. Okay, but it's not the first time God's told his people that they're kind of have a drinking problem. Remember that one prophecy we looked at a few weeks ago where these guys are drinking so much there's not even a clean place left on the table because they've been, yeah. I'll leave it there. Any comments, questions on 1 through 11 before we jump into verse 12? I always like us in these prophets to get the context. Okay, so, yeah, Israel's in trouble. Judah's not doing the right thing. And it wedged in this comes this messianic prophecy, verse 12. I will surely assemble all of you, Jacob. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together like sheep in the fold, like a flock in the midst of its pasture. They will be noisy with men. So these two verses here, verses 12 and 13, focus on the flock of God and its leader. So we see the flock of God in verse 12, and then we'll see its leader in verse 13. Again, we see Jesus with his church. As we've gotten further and further throughout this study, we see the Messiah, and then we see his church closely behind. And in this case, being described as sheep, as a flock. The people would be greatly reduced in size because he calls them the remnant of Israel. We've covered the concept of a remnant quite a bit. But what that tells us is that Israel is going to go from a multitude and it's going to be whittled down to a small amount. Okay? And then the other thing we can see is that they will need to be gathered, which tells us they were scattered. Okay? Now, these are pretty powerful Old Testament concepts. The idea of a remnant, very, very popular theme throughout the prophets, and the idea of gathering that remnant because it's scattered. This gathering would begin with the physical remnant of Israel, and clearly scattered, once at the hands of Assyria, and then when they were taken in captivity to Babylon, as Matthew's gospel calls it, the deportation to Babylon. They were able to return back. And so this idea of, you know, Israel being, you know, whittled down in size and then kind of scattered abroad, like we've already covered that in many of our prophecies, okay? That has its immediate fulfillment when Israel comes back out of the deportation of Babylon. Okay? Like that happens. That's a thing. But as we see with so many of God's teachings in the Old Testament, it's a foreshadow and a type of the gospel gathering that's taking place during the church age. Does that make sense? So we have many people that are scattered and lost, right? If we remember Isaiah 53 from last week, the prophet prophesied, each one of us, like sheep, have gone astray. Okay, so the people do scatter away, but there is a remnant that will be saved. So this does have immediate fulfillment in the Old Testament, specifically when they come back from the Babylonian captivity. But understand, like the flood and like the wilderness and like the Exodus and all these things in the Old Testament, they're a foreshadow and a type. So what it's going to foreshadow and what it's going to type is the gospel gathering that's taking place during the church age, the period that, we're in now. If we go back to Isaiah chapter 28, we'll look at a few verses here in Isaiah and in Romans just to further illustrate this point. Isaiah chapter 28, verse 1. Okay, woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim. See, they had a drinking problem for a long time. All right, this is not a new thing. To the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley, of those who are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a strong and mighty agent, as a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters. He has cast it down to the earth with his hand. The proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim is trodden underfoot. And the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley, will be like the first ripe figs prior to summer, which one sees, and as soon as it's in his hand, he swallows it. In that day, the Lord of hosts will become a beautiful crown and a glorious diadem to the remnant of his people. You guys remember this one? We covered this one. Okay? Now, Jesus specifically, I mean, he is the proud crown. Okay, but he's going to show up even largely here in verse 16. And I want us to jump there, but before we do, just notice, Israel's in its drunkenness, God's going to destroy it, and in that day, okay, the beautiful crown and glorious diadem of the Lord, he will become a glorious diadem to the remnant of his people. All right? So again, physically speaking, historically speaking, God did that through Babylon. When he restored them, he allowed them to go back to the region of Jerusalem and rebuild. Okay, it has its fulfillment. But is that when Jesus came? No, Jesus comes hundreds of years later. So this, because this is messianic prophecy, tells us that although it has its physical fulfillment in the nation of Israel, it's looking forward to Jesus. We went through this one. We know that. Verse 16. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone. I will speak out. Oh, I just lost my page. I'm going back. A tested stone, a costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed, and he who believes in it will not be disturbed. Okay, so maybe I'm belaboring it, or I'm actually losing you, or I'm just not doing a good job. These have physical fulfillments, but we already went through Isaiah. We understand that he is looking to Jesus and the church. So when the Old Testament talks about a remnant, yeah, Isaiah got whittled down at the hands of the Assyrians. Israel, go back and listen to that one, right, Kevin? Israel got whittled down. They are this remnant. And then they were scattered into Babylon, and they were gathered back together. And that all happened in the Old Testament. Okay, but what Isaiah is trying to tell us is that that has its ultimate fulfillment when Jesus comes for the remnant. Well, who did Jesus come for? His church. So it has its spiritual fulfillment. So I want us to see that, because when the Old Testament talks about the remnant, that's what it's ultimately looking forward to. Okay, now, if we didn't already have weren't convicted on that in Isaiah 28, Romans 9 is going to explain this further for us. Romans 9:22. What if God, although willing to demonstrate his wrath and to make his power known, endured with much patience vessels of wrath prepared for destruction? And he did so to make known the riches of his glory upon vessels of mercy, which he prepared beforehand for glory. Even us, whom he also called, not from among Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles. Okay. So God's got a plan. He's been very patient to execute his plan. And his plan includes the Jews and the Gentiles. And his point that it includes the Jews and the Gentiles is very important for the Roman reader. That's why it's in here. Verse 25. As he also says in Hosea, here's his proof text for why the Gentiles are allowed into the church of God. I will call those who were not my people, my people, and her who are not beloved, beloved. We've covered this. And it shall be said to them in that place that you are not my people. There they shall be called the sons of the living God. Okay, there's Paul's proof text for why the Gentiles are in. Okay, verse 27, Isaiah cries out concerning Israel. Okay, now here's his proof text that the Jews are allowed in God's church. Okay, though the number of the sons of Israel be like the sand of the sea, it is the remnant that will be saved. For the Lord will execute his word on the earth thoroughly and quickly. Brethren, does that make sense? Uh-oh. Was there a physical nation of Israel that got whittled down, went into Babylon, spent 70 years there, allowed to go back, and God gathered them back into their land so that that was the place in which Jesus was brought into this world? Yes. And was it a remnant? Yes. But what did Paul say has the remnant has its ultimate fulfillment according to prophecy of Isaiah? When the Jews converted to being disciples of Christ. That's when the remnant is brought in. Thank you for the head nodders. Okay, yeah. I need that. I need to know. I mean, maybe I'm not doing a good job, or, you know, it's just, you know, Christmas week, or, you know, whatever. But okay, so very important. His proof text for the fact that the Jews can be vessels of mercy prepared for honor and glory is this quote from Isaiah chapter 10. Okay. Now he goes down and tells us a little bit how the Gentiles kind of found this and how the Jews stumbled. And he says in verse 32, why? Why did the Jews stumble? Because they didn't pursue it by faith, but as though it were by works. Insert the Pharisee, right? It's like you have people who have been blind their whole life and now they can see. And you're like, wow, that's really cool. Jesus, your message might be from heaven. Might we ask you some questions? No, they didn't say that. They said you did it on the Sabbath. See, they missed it because they were too worried about the rules, the law. Okay? And they stumbled over the stumbling stone just as it is written. Now here's what we just read from Isaiah 28. Behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, and he who believes in him will not be disappointed. So I just wanted to see how all of that ties together, showing that when the scripture is talking about a remnant and a gathering, it has its ultimate fulfillment during the gospel dispensation in the church age. That's now. Okay? All right, let me go back to Micah. It had another verse, but I want us to get through this. You can go check out Romans 11 if you want. It's going to speak very similar. So what we see here in Micah is we have a focus on the sheep of Israel. Jesus also said that he had other sheep, though, didn't he? So I think that's not being quoted here in John chapter 10, but we know John chapter 10, right? You know, my sheep know my voice, I know them and they know me. Okay, those who are faithful, they cannot be snatched out of Jesus' hand. Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, I lay down my life for the sheep. And then he throws this little nugget in there. He says, I have other sheep, which are not of this fold, okay? And they need to be brought in. All right, I'm skipping that, but I think we're pretty familiar with John chapter 10. But that's going to come in here in Micah. Very cool. So, does anybody have King James? I guess we always have the phones, right? Anybody willing to open their King James or flip open to... I usually use Jared for this. Lorenzo, you got it. In Micah chapter 2, would you read verse 12 when I get here?
The old King James or the new King James?
Let's go with the old.
Okay. Verse 12. I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I'll put them together as sheep of Bozrah, as the flock in the midst of their fold. They shall make great noise by reason of a multitude of men.
Okay, so very close to the NASB, but there's one glaringly obvious word that shows up in the King James that's not in the NASB. What was it? Bozra. And the one thing that, if you don't have it open in the King James, is Bozra is capitalized, so it's a proper noun. And the reason why Bozra is capitalized is because it's a proper noun because it's a city. Now, I'm going to say I think it's in Edom, but we will backtrack here, and we'll either prove or disprove that statement. So I don't have to go back and listen to it later. We'll just do it right now. But this word Bozrah, that the King James translates Bozrah, is what we have in our NASB as in the fold. So in verse 12, we talked about how Israel's going to be assembled and gathered. Okay, so they were scattered. And he's going to assemble and gather the remnant. So they've been whittled down to a small amount. I will put them together like sheep, Bozrah. I will put them together like sheep in a fold. All right, so a group. A group. Now the Gentiles are going to play a pretty big role in this here in just a minute. But just notice, he's gathering in his church. He's gathering it in. Now, the reason why Bozrah shows up, and I don't think the NASB here misses by not translating it Bozrah, because these are actually two different words. Well, I guess I should say this. There are two different words in the Hebrew that are being ascribed different Hebrew numbers. Makes sense? You know how we're like it's Strong's, you know, H, you know, 1,000. Like, there's two different numbers for these two different words, but they are, if you look them up, they're basically the same word. And I bring this up because what I think is happening here is, maybe you guys know this, like our town is called Billings. That's named after a guy, okay? But there are lots of regions in the world that are named after things because they have names, right? It was Lorenzo that was preaching through Samuel. He was talking about when Uzzah sticks out and touches the Ark of the Covenant, right? And so David's upset, but in that moment, he names that place Perez Uzzah, right? And it means something, okay? And I forget the literal, but it has to do with the fact that that's what just happened. So we name regions based on things that happen there, or things that those regions are known for. Does that make sense? So this word means a group of sheep. And this city called Bozrah, if we go over to Amos, let's just back here a couple minor prophets, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. If we go to Amos chapter 1, again, sorry, I don't have the headings, but if you look at Amos chapter 1, I imagine it says something along the lines of judgment. If they do a really good job, they should title it Judgment on the Nations, okay? Because if you look in verse 6, transgressions of Gaza, verse 9, transgressions of Tyre, verse 11, transgressions of Edom. Now, what town did I say Bozrah was in? Okay, so I got that right. So now we see in verse 12, in the context of God's judgment through Amos to Edom, in verse 12, he says, I will send fire upon Teman, the city in Edom, and it will consume the citadels of Bozrah. So all you're seeing there are cities in the region of Edom. And God's just, you know, just like Jesus did in his ministry, professing judgment against them because of their wicked ways. Okay, now why did we just spend 5 minutes on Bozrah? Well, Bozrah was known for its many folds of sheep. Okay, so like, you guys remember? Can you hear the, just from your Old Testament Bible reading, the bulls of Bashan? Okay, well, why are there so many bulls in Bashan? Well, Bashan's grassland. It's primarily grassland. Okay, nice and flat grass. So that's where all the cattle were. Okay, you've got the Oaks of Mamre, right? It's like, well, lots of trees grow there, all right? So what happened in this region is this region was primarily known for its just massive herds of sheep. And so it got called Sheepfold. That's what its name means. Okay, so I do think the NASB does the right job calling it Sheepfold in Micah because it is technically a different word, but this city got its name from that word. Does that make sense? It's the difference between the guy whose last name really was Billings and Billings, Montana. That's the difference. Only in this case, Bozrah means sheepfold. All right? So, now if we're starting to get lost, like I am, if we come back to Micah chapter 2, what's his point here? He's going to bring the sheep in, and he will put them together like Bozrah, like a region that has a lot of sheep. It will be known for its sheep. So we understand that the gate is narrow that leads to life, and few are those who find it. But God's gospel does go to the whole world, right? And you see this initially, at least in the first few years of the gospel, you see this, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of Jews turning to the Lord, right? But then what happens when this thing opens up to the Gentiles? It's like, they just start coming in. Okay? And so this thing goes to the whole world. Okay, now when we look out into the world, we see less people are making it than are. Right? But what the prophet's working on here and what God is working on is that when this shepherd comes, when this breaker comes, okay, he's going to be assembling his sheep. And he's going to bring a lot of them in. Okay, so that's kind of how that Bozrah is coming through there. I said this could be showing the success of God's gathering and especially the expansion of the incoming Gentiles. If we look at the last two lines here in verse 12, he says, like a flock in the midst of its pasture, they will be noisy with men. Why is it loud? There's a lot of people there. Right? You know, I don't know how many people we're usually about 150 strong here on Lord's Day morning. And you guys are all typically pretty quiet while I'm preaching. And as soon as we finish that last song, you all stand up and say, hey, where are you going for lunch? Want to come? Like, how was your week? You know, and you guys, and it erupts in conversation in here. It's noisy chatter. And so that's the picture the prophet's giving us. He's going to bring in these sheep. He's going to bring them into a sheepfold, but it's the word that the town actually derives its name from and is known for having a lot of sheep. And there's a lot there, so it's bustling and it's busy and it's loud. Verse 13. The breaker goes up before them. They break out, pass through the gate, and go out by it. So their king goes on before them, and the Lord at their head. I got 5 minutes to do it. So hang on. This is a new one. The name for Messiah is Breaker. Now, how do I know that? Well, who leads the Lord's sheep? The shepherd? John chapter 10, right? Jesus. He also gets the name King. Did Jesus affirm to Pilate that he was a king? Yep. And last line in verse 13, he also gets the name Yahweh. Is Jesus Jehovah? Okay, so parallelism would tell us that these names all refer to the same person. But the one that's a little unique is Breaker. Okay, actually, and that, I'm wondering, Kendall, do you guys still have that poster? Maybe many of us have it. Do you still have that poster at the house of the names of Jesus? I'd be really curious to see if Breaker, you know, Lamb of God, right there, top 10. You know, Wonderful Counselor, top 5. Okay, Redeemer, Advocate. I wonder if Breaker makes it. So I'll get your guys' thoughts on this, my way to wrap it up quicker. Why is he called Breaker? I mean, I'm not trying to trick you guys. I mean, yeah, he breaks the chains of sin, right? I mean, look at the next two lines. It calls him King and Yahweh, but he's leading, isn't he? Our King is leading. Yahweh is our head. I think he says head. Yeah, he says he's our head. Okay, so our God, our Messiah, is leading us. Okay, so, you know, if you're ever playing Red Rover, get behind Jesus. Okay, because he's going to break her on through. Now, I don't have time to cover all of this. We do need to turn to Romans 8, because Larry's absolutely right. Many times Jesus was asked, you know, and Are you going to lead your people to victory? And he's like, well, nope. Is it now you're going to restore the kingdom of Israel? Nope. Because that's not what Jesus was interested in breaking the Israelites from. He wants to be able to break mankind free away from their sin. So in Romans chapter 8, verse 3 tells us what the law couldn't do, weak as though it was through the flesh, God did. By sending his son in the likeness of flesh and as an offering from sin, he condemned sin in the flesh. So what was it that God did that the law couldn't do? Condemn sin in the flesh. Now, he did it by sending Jesus and having Jesus be the sacrifice. And the verse tells us that the law couldn't do it because it was fleshly and weak. But that's what God did. Through Jesus' sacrifice was for once a man lived perfectly, condemned sin and the flesh, and now he is the firstborn from the dead. Okay, Revelation chapter 1 introduces Jesus as the firstborn one from among the dead. Okay, and then obviously we get to follow in his footsteps. The other thing I like about Micah chapter 2 here is we wrap up with our last couple minutes. So he breaks out, busts the gate open. The people are able to go out. And then he gets the second title, king. But the king goes on before them. So Jesus isn't asking us to do anything that he hasn't done himself, which is really important. Okay. It was fitting for him to be made like us in all things, Hebrews says. Okay, so that he could be a merciful and faithful high priest. Okay. Very important that we remember God is not asking us to do anything that he hasn't already done himself. He's leading. He's the one that knocked down that dividing wall and that barrier between the law that separated the Jew from the Gentile. He broke that down, and now we get to follow in his footsteps. The third title he's given is Yahweh. He is Jehovah. The Redeemer and Shepherd of man is none other than God himself. Similarly, we see here, as he's given the name Lord, he is at their head. So as the king he was leading, if you're going to bust through that door, you got to be the first one there. If you're going to lead your army into battle, you got to be in the front lines. Our king is doing that for us. But as Yahweh, he is also the head. And the scripture continually reinforces for us at least four places in the New Testament that we are the body and he is the head. Okay, so he gets to be the brains of the operation too. So he's the one that maps out the plan and then goes out and executes it, and he leads for us. We are the body. Jesus is the head. We follow him. We are able to march victoriously into any situation because Jesus is our leader. He is our leader. So that's Micah chapter 2.